times in different directions. When we finally arrived at his house, it was late afternoon. I tried to question him about the events of the day. He explained that talking was unnecessary. For the time being, I had to refrain from asking questions until we were in a place of power. I was dying to know what he meant by that, and tried to whisper a question, but he reminded me with a cold, severe look that he meant business. We sat on the porch for hours. I worked on my notes. From time to time, he handed me a piece of dry meat. Finally, it was too dark to write. I tried to think about the new developments, but some part of myself refused to, and I fell asleep. Saturday, August 19th, 1961. Yesterday morning, Don Juan and I drove to town and ate breakfast at a restaurant. He advised me not to change my eating habits too drastically.
"Your body's not used to power meat," he said. "You'd get sick if you didn't eat your food."
He himself ate heartily. When I joked about it, he simply said, "My body likes everything." Around noon, we hiked back to the water canyon. We proceeded to make ourselves noticeable to the spirit by noisy talk and by a forced silence, which lasted hours. When we left the place, instead of heading back to the house, Don Juan took off in the direction of the mountains. We reached some mild slopes first, and then we climbed to the top of some high hills. There, Don Juan picked out a spot to rest in the open, unshaded area. He told me that we had to wait until dusk and that I should conduct myself in the most natural fashion, which included asking all the questions I wanted.
"I know that the spirit is out there lurking," he said in a very low voice.
"Where?"
"Out there, in the bushes."
"What kind of spirit is it?" He looked at me with a quizzical expression and retorted,
"How many kinds are there?"
We both laughed. I was asking questions out of nervousness.
"It'll come out at dusk," he said. "We just have to wait."
I remained quiet. I had run out of questions.
"This is the time when we must keep on talking," he said. "The human voice attracts spirits. There's one lurking out there now. We're making ourselves available to it, so keep on talking."
I experienced an idiotic sense of vacuity. I couldn't think of anything to say. He laughed and patted me on the back.
"You're truly a pill," he said. "When you have to talk, you lose your tongue. Come on, beat your gums."
He made a hilarious gesture of beating his gums together, opening and closing his mouth with great speed.
"There's certain things we'll talk about from now on only at places of power," he went on. "I've brought you here because this is your first trial. This is a place of power, and here we can talk only about power."
"I really don't know what power is," I said.
"Power is something a warrior deals with," he said. "At first it's an incredible, far-fetched affair. It's hard to even think about it. This is what's happening to you now. Then, power becomes a serious matter. One may not have it, or one may not even fully realize that it exists. Yet one knows that something is there. Something which was not noticeable before. Next, power is manifested as something uncontrollable that comes to oneself. It's not possible for me to say how it comes or what it really is. It is nothing, and yet it makes marvels appear before your very eyes. And finally, power is something in oneself, something that controls one's acts and yet obeys one's command."
There was a short pause. Don Juan asked me if I had understood. I felt ludicrous saying I did. He seemed to have noticed my dismay and chuckled.
"I am going to teach you right here the first step to power," he said, as if he were dictating a letter to me. "I am going to teach you how to set up dreaming."
He looked at me and again asked me if I knew what he meant. I did not. I was hardly following him at all. He explained that to set up dreaming meant to have a concise and pragmatic control over the general situation of a dream, comparable to the control one has over any choice in the desert, such as climbing up a hill or remaining in the shade of a water canyon. "You must start by doing something very simple," he said. "Tonight, in your dreams, you must look at your hands." I laughed out loud. His tone was so factual that it was as if he were telling me to do something commonplace. "Why do you laugh?" he asked with surprise. "How can I look at my hands in my dreams?" "Very simple. Focus your eyes on them, just like this." He bent his head forward and stared at his hands with his mouth open. His gesture was so comical that I had to laugh. "Seriously, how can you expect me to do that?" I asked. "The way I've told you," he snapped. "You can, of course, look at whatever you goddamn please, your toes or your belly or your pecker for that matter. I said your hands because that's the easiest thing for me to look at. Don't think it's a joke. Dreaming is as serious as seeing or dying or any other thing in this awesome, mysterious world. Think of it as something entertaining. Imagine all the inconceivable things you could accomplish. A man hunting for power has almost no limits in his dreaming." I asked him to give me some pointers. "There aren't any pointers," he said. "Just look at your hands."
"There must be more that you could tell me," I insisted. He shook his head and squinted his eyes, staring at me in short glances.
"Every one of us is different," he finally said. "What you call pointers would only be what I myself did when I was learning. We are not the same. We aren't even vaguely alike."
"Maybe anything you'd say would help me."
"It would be simpler for you just to start looking at your hands."
He seemed to be organizing his thoughts and bobbed his head up and down.
"Every time you look at anything in your dreams, it changes shape," he said after a long silence. "The trick in learning to set up dreaming is obviously not just to look at things, but to sustain the sight of them. Dreaming is real when one has succeeded in bringing everything into focus. Then there is no difference between what you do when you sleep and what you do when you are not sleeping. Do you see what I mean?"
I confessed that although I understood what he had said, I was incapable of accepting his premise. I brought up the point that in a civilized world there were scores of people who had delusions and could not distinguish what took place in the real world from what took place in their fantasies. I said that such persons were undoubtedly mentally ill, and my uneasiness increased every time he would recommend I should act like a crazy man. After my long explanation, Don Juan made a comical gesture of despair by putting his hands to his cheeks and sighing loudly.
"Leave your civilized world alone," he said. "Let it be. Nobody is asking you to behave like a madman. I've already told you, a warrior has to be perfect in order to deal with the powers he hunts. How can you conceive that a warrior would not be able to tell things apart? On the other hand, you, my friend, who know what the real world is, would fumble and die in no time at all if you would have to depend on your ability for telling what is real and what is not."
I, obviously, had not expressed what I really had in mind. Every time I protested, I was simply voicing the unbearable frustration of being in an untenable position.
"I'm not trying to make you into a sick, crazy man," Don Juan went on. "You can do that yourself without my help. But the forces that guide us brought you to me.
and I have been endeavoring to teach you to change your stupid ways and live the strong, clean life of a hunter. Then the forces guided you again and told me that you should learn to live the impeccable life of a warrior. Apparently, you can't. But who can tell? We are as mysterious and as awesome as this unfathomable world. So who can tell what you're capable of? There was an underlying tone of sadness in Don Juan's voice. I wanted to apologize, but he began to talk again.
You don't have to look at your hands, he said. Like I said, pick anything at all. But pick one thing in advance and find it in your dreams. I said your hands because they'll always be there. When they begin to change shape, you must move your sight away from them and pick something else. And then look at your hands again. It takes a long time to perfect this technique.
I had become so involved in writing that I hadn't noticed that it was getting dark. The sun had already disappeared over the horizon. The sky was cloudy, and the twilight was imminent. Don Juan stood up and gave furtive glances towards the south.
"Let's go," he said. "We must walk south until the spirit of the waterhole shows itself."
We walked for perhaps half an hour. The terrain changed abruptly, and we came to a barren area. There was a large round hill where the chaparral had burnt. It looked like a bald head. We walked towards it. I thought that Don Juan was going to climb the mild slope, but he stopped instead and remained in a very attentive position. His body seemed to have tensed as a single unit and shivered for an instant. Then he relaxed again and stood limply. I couldn't figure out how his body could remain erect while his muscles were so relaxed. At that moment, a very strong gust of wind jolted me. Don Juan's body turned in the direction of the wind, towards the west. He didn't use his muscles to turn, or at least he didn't use them the way I would use mine to turn. Don Juan's body seemed rather to have been pulled from the outside. It was as if someone else had arranged his body to face a new direction. I kept on staring at him. He looked at me from the corner of his eye. The expression on his face was one of determination, purpose. All of his being was attentive. And I stared at him in wonder. I had never been in any situation that called for such a strange concentration. Suddenly his body shivered as though he had been splashed by a sudden shower of cold water. He had another jolt, and then he started to walk as if nothing had happened. I followed him. We flanked the naked hills on the east side until we were at the middle part of it. He stopped there, turning to face the west. From where we stood, the top of the hill was not so round and smooth as it had seemed to be from the distance. There was a cave, or a hole, near the top. I looked at it fixedly, because Don Juan was doing the same. Another strong gust of wind sent a chill up my spine. Don Juan turned towards the south and scanned the area with his eyes.
"There,"
he said in a whisper, and pointed to an object on the ground. I strained my eyes to see. There was something on the ground, perhaps 20 feet away. It was light brown, and as I looked at it, it shivered. I focused all my attention on it. The object was almost round and seemed to be curled. In fact, it looked like a curled-up dog. "What is it?" I whispered to Don Juan.
"I don't know,"
he whispered back as he peered at the object.
"What does it look like to you?"
I told him that it seemed to be a dog.
"Too large for a dog," he said matter-of-factly.
I took a couple of steps towards it, but Don Juan stopped me gently. I stared at it again. It was definitely some animal that was either asleep or dead. I could almost see its head. Its ears protruded like the ears of a wolf. By then I was definitely sure that it was a curled-up animal. I thought that it could have been a brown calf. I whispered that to Don Juan. He answered that it was too compact to be a calf. Besides, its ears were pointed. The animal shivered again, and then I noticed that it was alive.
I could actually see that it was breathing, yet it didn't seem to breathe rhythmically. The breaths that it took were more like irregular shivers. I had a sudden realization at that moment. "It's an animal that is dying,"